Session number 13265, reel number 15.
Mr. Marsden, reel 15.
When Willie taxied the kite in and parked it, he got out and his face was as red as a turkey cock's and he was absolutely livid. Well, that's a contrast in terms, isn't it? Livid and red as a turkey cock. Doesn't go. He was furious anyway. We walked round to the rear end of the kite and we could see that the fixings for the fillets round the tail plane now had slot holes under the mushroom heads of the fixing screws, and it was quite apparent that the tail plane had been floating on the front pins. The tail plane of the Halifax was fixed with two pins horizontally, the leading at the front edge end of the tail plane, front edge, and the rear pins on the main spar of the tail plane were vertical, for pins read bolts, if you wish. And the rear bolts had loosened off as a result of aerodynamic buffeting caused by the holes left by the absence of the undercarriage doors, so that the wheel well created a turbulence, and this buffeted the tail plane, which was not particularly apparent in flight. It hadn't been greatly noticed by anyone. I'd never noticed it when we were flying, and no pilots had mentioned it particularly. And I can't remember whether the aeroplane had done an operation or two in that state. But anyway, the locking wire, I think, had sheared, and the castle knots had slackened off, so that there was about half an inch of movement on the tailplane or thereabouts, and it was this which caused the reversal of control. Down elevator produced a load on the tailplane which pushed the tailplane up, so the tailplane, which was greater in area than the elevators, took over control. So you gave down elevator and got up tailplane. So you ended up with that, in effect, having a kind of all-flying tailplane. And that, of course, had rather disconcerted Wing Commander Tate, and he didn't like it. And it's not surprising. If you are used to landing an aircraft by following a series of movements just so, it's very awkward to suddenly find that you have to do them all in reverse. And that 120, 180 miles an hour, close to the deck, it is quite unhandy. So he was annoyed. And he was annoyed with me because I was NCOIC the aircraft. And we had a look round, and of course, it was obvious as to the cause of the bother. As a result of this, all the Halifaxes were immediately grounded in the group and elsewhere. I think at this time, four group had Halifaxes only. I can be wrong. And there was at least one squadron of Halifaxes operating from, I think, Tempsford, in largely all black livery, operating into Europe on the dropping Joes and dropping airborne drops of supplies. I'm not sure, in fact, if there had been an attempt or if they were used in an attempt to drop supplies into Warsaw, but that would be later on. I'm not too clear of the chronology there. Anyway, it caused a fair old hoo-ha. And in the unit, Chiefy Murray, our flight sergeant, technical, was so cross over the whole business that he insisted that I do flight checks on all the other aircraft in the unit and fly test flights using a pair of feelers to see if there was any movement on the rear of the tailplane. I could put the blade of a feeler gauge up to the seat of the each tailplane bolt where the tailplane was anchored down, and in flight to see if I could get feeler gauges in between, and if so, how much, and report on it. And of course, that was no real hardship to me because I quite like flying, so I got a little bit of extra flying in at that time. And I think that my aircraft, which had, I think, been longest without undercarriage doors, was really the only one where there was any problem of that kind of severity. I'm not sure that I don't know whether any others were found in the group or on any of the conversion flights. And I do know that the other aircraft which had been modified on our unit were all good as gold. There was no observable movement on them, so it was no great problem. It was an obvious cause and an obvious fix. It wasn't anything inherently wrong with the aeroplane. Now, shall I go back to Scampton?
Yes, certainly.
Perhaps you might kill it just first and let me check.
Yes, this is returning to the early part of your career with 83 Squadron at Scampton in 39.
Yes.
Some additional points.
Yes. In 1940... whilst I was still at Locking, I met a couple of chaps who'd been on 83 Squadron when I'd been there in 39, and they'd been posted onto courses at Locking, and we were talking about the squadron, and they told me of a couple of incidents which had occurred and which I hadn't heard of. One of them is rather amusing in a way. A peculiarity of the Hampton. You have to imagine that you're looking at the Hampton sideways. If you open the rear gunners, the under rear gunners' hatches, such as he would do to use his gun, and open the cupola over the wireless operator's position as well, the aerodynamics are such that you get a flow of air through from below. Even though the aircraft is travelling at 200 miles an hour, you get a flow of air coming through into the lower air gunner's face, sweeping round vertically in a semicircle and out through the upper hatch, the upper opening. And to put it in delicately, that flow of air was so strong that it was one of the tricks that you could do in a Hampton was, instead of using the airborne tube for relieving bladders, you could pee straight into the airstream in the lower position as though you were firing a gun, and the water, the urine, would flow back in a neat line up past your face without touching it and out through the upper hole. Which, of course, people would try just for the fun of it, so they could say they'd done it. All right, that is the peculiarity of the airflow. Now, when aircraft went on air-to-sea firing, it was customary to throw out an air-to-sea marker, which was a canister about the size of a very large cocoa tin, say 10 inches. I'm speaking from memory now, but probably 10 inches or 12 inches long, about 3-4 inches in diameter, and it had a cap which was fastened on with adhesive tape, and the thing was filled with very fine aluminium powder, so that when you pull off the adhesive tape and loosen the cap and throw it down onto the sea, when it hits the sea, the thing bursts the cap off and the aluminium powder spreads over the surface of the sea and makes a silver slick, which you can then use as a target for firing the guns at. And you make repeated passes over it with the upper and lower rear gunners firing, and possibly the observer in front with his single gun, or even the pilot making a pass using his Vickers gun. Well, that's the usual thing. Now, we have an aircraft up on air-to-sea firing with a Sprog rear gunner. First time up, not a clue. So they tell him to throw out the sea marker. He takes the sea marker, peels the thing off, takes the lid off and pours it out. But the wireless operator's canopy wasn't open. So instead of the airflow taking all this aluminium powder past the air gunner and up and out, it went into the airframe, into the aircraft itself, and filled the aircraft with a cloud of aluminium powder, which didn't do a lot for the electrics, for starters. Didn't help the radio, and didn't help the pilot either, because he got a face full. So every member of the crew ended up looking like an astronaut, and the kite staggered back to Scampton with everybody in a highly chocker state. And by the time they got it back, the aircraft, in fact, was... apart from the fact the engines ran and there were mechanical controls, the aircraft was totally US, because none of the electrics would work. And, in fact, we were told that the kite became a write-off, because you simply couldn't get electrics and radio to work properly. Well, of course, that's the kind of thing which is regarded with great hilarity in the mob, and I suppose it costs various people a few drinks, and the air gunner who did it would be rednecked for the rest of his career, I should think. The other thing we heard about was not really so funny. I think I heard about this later in 1940, because this particular thing happened either just about the time I left Locking or a little while after. It was a routine for barrack room inspections at Scampton. I was taught the method the very first time I was room orderly. The routine was to take a bucket full of petrol and dump into the bucket a whole tin of floor polish. Stir it up and dissolve it. And that was the barrack room floors at Scampton, on the new barracks, on the expansion type barracks, the E and H block type of thing, were parquet floors on the ground floor. I can't remember about upstairs. Anyway, we had parquet floors, solid wood blocks, and of course polished up to a high rate of shine for inspections. And the routine was to take a broom or a mop and tie a chunk of old blanket over it, dip it in the mixture of petrol and floor polish, and smear that over the whole floor. As you can imagine, the atmosphere was fairly lethal. Of course, all windows open and no smoking. This was understood. This was the routine which the regulars had followed, and probably everybody on the station was sort of brought up to it and understood it. I don't know whether the officers knew about it or anything, but this was the way it was done. You can imagine that the barrack blocks were in a highly dangerous state on Friday mornings. And frankly, when I was told what to do, I was distinctly leery about it. Well, after you spread the mixture and the petrol evaporated, you of course you had a very nice film of polish everywhere, and then you bumpered it up with the service bumper. You know about those, don't you?
The bumpers?
The bumpers. Oh, well, the bumpers, which were used for polishing the floors, were a long-handled, square-headed polishing mop. The head was heavy. It was about 12 or 14 inches by 6 and fixed to the handle on a swivel pin, so that if you got the thing long ways on and swung it across your front In a sweeping motion, the head would stay flat on the floor whilst the handle drove it across the floor, and you could get quite a long arc or sweep of coverage with it. The bumper, I can't remember whether the bumper had a felt face or a bristle face, but we used to bind over it several layers of old blanket to produce a burnishing surface. And with that, the floors were, as the saying went, boned up to the knocker. You produced a gloss you could use as a mirror. And woe betide anybody who dropped any dirt on it or stepped anywhere other than on a pair of pieces of blanket. If he was walking through until after the inspection, this was really 100% bull. And, all right, that's the way it was done, and it produced good results. In 1940, there were a couple of hurricane boxes, or aircraft boxes, which were being used as offices, and the same routine had been used in them for polishing the floor. Except that in the middle of all the preparations, some clown came in with a cigarette, and the whole thing went poof. And two or three bodies were carbonized. I should say, of course, that carbonize was a slang term picked up by British troops, British airmen, and RFC people in the First War from the French. When a kite went down in flames, the French described the pilot as being carbonized, in better French than mine. In other words, turned into charcoal or carbon. He'd been burned to death, and it became I won't say a popular term, but a term in current usage to describe people burned in that fashion. It produced quite a hoorah in the press at the time. There was it was at least a one-day wonder.
And did that put an end to that method of cleaning the floor?
Oh, my word, yes. I don't know whether there were any charges, 252s flying about at Scampton, but I can imagine that there must have been quite a stoppage on that particular method of polishing floors. It wasn't a method which I ever came across anywhere else in the service, but of course the service expanded so rapidly from 1939 that these practices by the regulars were soon so enormously diluted that they would tend to die out. And what's more, on very few stations could you calmly walk down to the hangars from the barracks with a bucket or two buckets, as I did, and go to an aircraft and drain off two buckets of petrol and carry them back to the barrack blocks without anybody querying you. But at Scampton I did it several times because I was told to do it by the senior man, and no one seemed to take note of it. But of course it would have been, I imagine, frowned upon most severely by any responsible person had they realised what was going on. Because had that happened in a barrack block on a Friday morning, the whole barrack block would have exploded, and there would have been probably about six men killed, burned. It would have been a very nasty affair. Well, a point I missed out in 1940, 3 points.
Relating to which station?
Relating to Tangmere and 145 Squadron. During the evacuation from France, or during the retreat from France, I can recall seeing flying overhead on a southeasterly course, I don't know if I mentioned this before, formations of tiger moths, harts and hinds, and similar biplane aircraft, by now mostly trainers in the service, but all bombed up with, I would guess, 20 or 50 pound bombs, according to the aircraft, and all heading out to sea. Now, where they went and what they did, I don't know. They certainly weren't on any training exercise. I can't imagine that such large formations, they were going over in blocks of 20, 30 aeroplanes, and they came back in dribs and drabs much later. I've always wondered where they were, if they had been flying across the channel to some place where our troops were getting out, and if they were being used to bomb inshore of our troops, or, you know, further in to delay oncoming Germans. There must have been some losses. It's not anything I've ever seen mentioned in the literature, but it would be worth investigation, because it would be, I think, it's the kind of thing that's worth at least a footnote in history. Because the chaps who were being sent out in those aircraft must have known very well that if anything serious came up against them, they'd had their lot. They weren't, apart from the fact that they were so slow, and Messerschmitts would, or anything else, would be overshooting all the time, they really hadn't got much going for them. And I think in question of range, Tiger Moth, I don't know what the endurance is, but I should think flying across to the Cherbourg area, which is where you would go from Tangmere, 90 miles, a Tiger Moth, 90 miles, call it 100, you'd have to reckon it would be on about 120, 130, 140 miles from takeoff to where it was going, the other side. So it would make it about a 300 mile flight, and I would think that would be pushing things a bit, especially if the wind was wrong as well, and carrying a load. So it would make an explanation for all that would be of some considerable interest, I think, to aviation historians.
How many did you see?
Well, I would think, I certainly saw coming up to 30 in the mental picture I can call up. I tend to call up sort of visuals against, looking at the visual, there would have been 20 or 30 of these aircraft at the very least. I can recall saying, look, there's an Audax, because my aircraft recognition in those days was a great deal better than it is today, and there were Hart variants as well as the Tiger Moths. Whether there were any other aircraft in that group, I can't recall. The other thing was that in June we had to reharmonise the guns on all our aircraft. It was discovered that the old system of harmonising the guns for a convergence range of 450 yards was quite useless. People were firing at ranges at which they couldn't possibly hit enemy aircraft or their targets. The Dowding spread, which I have an idea involved not specifically setting the eight guns of the Hurry or the Spit to cone in on a point. I think the Dowding spread was aimed at producing a spread of rounds at that particular range of harmonisation to maximise damage on the target aircraft. But it wasn't doing a lot of good. Shooting was poor. And so the guns were reharmonised down to either 200 or 250 yards. I think 200 yards would have been probably the better thing. But I can remember it being done, and I can remember being intrigued by the harmonising target, which was a board about 3 feet by 2 feet, with not a single cross on it, which you might have expected if the target had been, if the convergence point had been the aim. Of course, they weren't setting it at 200 yards to target the guns. This thing was set in front of the aircraft at a distance of about 25 yards, or maybe less, and it had 8 aiming points on, so that when the armourers inserted the periscopic telescope sights into the breeches of the gun to sight down the barrels so that each gun could be individually adjusted, each gun was then sighted onto its own particular dot on the target board. But the intriguing thing to me was that these dots were not a horizontal line. If you imagine the convergence of 8 lines from a battery of guns in a hurricane to a point, then they would come, you would expect them to come in a kind of equidistant fan for each of the 4 guns in the battery. And you would expect them, therefore, to produce on a target board 2 sets of 4 points, which would be equidistant, with the larger gap in the middle to take up the distance between the inboard guns in each wing. But no, they were in a kind of haphazard pattern. One gun might be on what you might assume to be a centre line, the next gun up, and the third gun very much down, and the fourth gun somewhere else on each side. Quite an irregular pattern. And I can remember asking the armourer how it or why it was that this curious pattern was being used, and he pointed out something which I should have thought of for myself, that the vibration of the guns firing and the effect of the individual gun mounts was such that in order to correct the variation in the way the guns were being fired or aimed by their own mountings, to produce the kind of result that was wanted, it had been established by experiment that aiming the guns in this particular fashion produced the kind of fire which you would have expected to be needed. In other words, more or less straight line pattern. So that this was one of those curiosities of ballistics, if you like, or gunfire, which was not understood or known by the average bud. I found that quite interesting. So that was all there was to that. And then in July we had to repaint our aircraft. Have I mentioned that one?
Don't think so.
Right. The word came out that the existing black and white camouflage scheme, if we can call it that, on the underside of our fighters up to this time, whereby one half of the plan view from nose to tail was black and the other half from nose to tail was white, or in a few cases was silver, this was causing recognition problems. It was claimed that people were wrongly identifying our aircraft as German because of this black and white colour scheme, which was very odd because all the German aircraft had a light blue under scheme, a similar a kind of sky blue scheme. At any rate, it was decided that this had to be changed. I thought it very odd because this black and white had the effect of breaking up the pattern of the aircraft.